Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's episode, we are going to talk about sparkling wine in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. On the podcast today is Kenny McMahon. Him and his wife, Allison, own Arabilis Wines. We're going to go through what makes the Willamette Valley so special. Before we do that, I want to remind everybody, our new film, Cup of Salvation, opens in theaters in New York City on December 7th and opens in Boston December 5th and 6th. Get your tickets at somfilms.com before they sell out, and they will. Without further ado, our conversation with Kenny McMahon about sparkling wines in the Willamette Valley.
Hello, my name is Claire Copey, and this week I am very lucky to be joined by the winemaker and co-founder of Arabilis Wine up in Oregon's Willamette Valley, Kenny McMahon. Hi, Kenny. How are you doing?
Hi, Claire. I'm doing wonderful. Can't complain.
Well, first of all, so tell me a little bit about the name Arabilis. It's a beautiful name. What does it mean? Where did you get that inspiration?
Yes, Arabilis. It's the Latin word for farmable or arable land. And it's aspirational. We hope to one day have our own estate that we can start making some estate wines. But it's also our mantra. And we're very intentional in terms of who we want to partner with in terms of the farming and the practices and values that they have. So it's definitely something that we all, my wife and I, Allison, she's the other co-founder, and my CEO, we definitely team up on that. So
you mentioned you don't have your own estate vineyards yet. How many other vineyards are you sourcing from and working with at the moment?
We are sourcing from 9 this year, maybe 10. 80% of it's Eola Amity Hills. We get a little bit from the Van Duzer AVA, and then we got some from the McMinnville AVA, the Coast Range.
We're going to talk a lot about sparkling wine in Oregon, which I think is a category that people are missing out on. When people think about Oregon wines, they go to Pinot Noir, and of course, amazing Pinot Noirs, Pinot Gris, and some amazing Chardonnays as well. So you're taking these grapes and you're making traditional method sparkling wines, which is arguably the hardest style of wine to make. What led you to want to make sparkling wines? Again, you have these gorgeous still Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays. Was it always sparkling wine that you wanted to start making, or was it a recent inspiration?
It's been our North Star for the longest time, is to make traditional method sparkling wine, and having that focus primarily. We needed, and practically, you know, as all winemaking, I mean, we had to start out with some still wines, and we would have been amiss if we didn't make a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. Like, there's just so many great vineyards, and our first wine that we made was top tier vineyard sites in the Eola Hills, same with 2019. But it's always been on the back of my mind to make traditional method sparkling. And yes, it's a hard product to make. Like, why not just make it even harder by increasing our inventory, making wines 3 times, constant touching and a finicky, like, let's just throw it all in the mix and make it that much more complex. But it's worth it. And we think Oregon has a really bright future for traditional method sparkling wine to take advantage of the grapes that have already been planted for that infrastructure.
From the research I've done about Arabilis, you have a wonderful ethos and philosophy behind the whole thing. Before we get deeper into Arabilis, though, I want to know a little bit about your background, because you have a really cool journey into winemaking. So where did that all start, and what was the spark that drove you towards wine?
I was 12 years old, and so, like, being 12, yeah, it was Rombauer Chardonnay. It's funny enough, but we were on a family wine trip to Napa, and the winemaker was like, meet us up in the mountains. We're picking Chardonnay, and our family friends were like, hey, we want to be there for the pick. So reached my hand over, tasted Chardonnay as a kid. And, you know, I can remember that day. It was foggy. Bees were buzzing. Forklifts were driving, humming. Like, it was chaos. So to me, it was just like that Ratatouille, you know, that Pixar movie that, like,
yeah,
it just
all those different explosions
back.
And oh yeah, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
like you just go back and it's clearly there, and you can smell it and see it and feel it. Yeah,
100%. So that moment was the impetus of finding a program that studied why memories drive the sensory around wine. And there's only a few programs in the country that do that, and then there are some in Europe as well. But that's how I ended up at Washington State University, was studying food science and sensory science and why memories are driven by chemicals and such. So
that's the coolest thing, because as having been a sommelier, you taste a lot of wines. And I always found the wines that I remember the most and that I enjoyed the most usually linked up with a memory that I had completely forgotten about. Either it's a smell, a taste, and it's like that Ratatouille thing. You're just immediately zoomed off to another place in time. And I always think that those are the best wines. So that's really cool. I didn't realize that there were universities and programs out there that taught that, and then especially related to wine.
Yeah, and it's food. Wild. Yeah, no, and it's wild. It can be anything, right? Like for me too, growing up in the Midwest, it was, you know, baked macaroni and cheese for my grandma. Like,
oh, nice.
That, you know, that was another one. But it's all these, it could be any food, wine, whichever. But yeah, the program's food science. My dissertation happened to be on sparkling wine.
I love the way I'm from the Midwest as well. The baked mac and cheese too is a big one. Big one for
you
me.
Know.
So I
you
completely
know.
Empathize with that. Oh yeah. I definitely know. I love the way that you describe, again, going back to the ethos of Arabalus, that it is all tied into the senses. And I'm going to pull a quote from your website, if you don't mind. We are constantly on the watch to better appreciate the vine's natural beauty by observing, feeling, tasting, listening, touching. The sensorial curiosity translates over into the wine structure and complexity. And I love that completely immersive way of thinking about wine, and that you're taking that approach into the vineyard. It's very romantic. And it's also the way that, you know, sommeliers, and when you're tasting a glass of wine, the way you break it down, it's all these different senses. Even if you look at the deductive, you know, blind tasting grid, it's sight, smell, taste. It's all of these things. So I love, 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 love that approach.
And it starts there. That's the beginning of the wine creation, right? So we're walking the vineyards. We're on site with the crews when they're picking. It's just trying to ensure the utmost quality of the wine in the end. So, you know, I think having the opportunity to live where we are and being so close proximity to the vineyard sites that we do partner with, it's very easy and convenient. And we're fortunate to have this opportunity to live here, but it allows us to just really be in tune with each site.
And that is actually, you bring up a good point, because not having your own estate vineyards, that I think is equally impressive that you're going to all these different sites and you're so hands-on, because I don't think you find that with a lot of winemakers who are, you know, leasing this fruit basically. You don't really see them going in the vineyards day after day to connect with their fruit like that. So that's very cool.
It's a borderline obsession. My wife might ding
passion,
me for it.
You're so yeah.
Yes.
So, and you met your wife at school, yeah? When you were when you were studying all this.
The funny story is she was my tour guide. So it so showed up. I thought I was going into the mountains to be a skier and such, and then realized I was in the middle of wheat country in eastern Washington. So yeah, she was my tour guide, and the first class we went to was sensory science, and yeah, I was hooked.
What was her focus in school?
It was the same. So we were actually in the same lab. She studied red wine finish. So there were a couple of things she did, but mostly Syrah was what she worked on. Basically how certain wine processing impacts the final finish. So I'm speaking in layman's terms, a longer finish.
Thank you.
Equates to a higher quality wine, but it has to be the right finish. You know,
you don't want anything too harsh or astringent or, yeah. Was that something that you'd always talked about then as you were, you know, getting to know each other more? That was that like a dream for you too, you know, to have your own winery?
It was. We wrote a business plan before we graduated.
Wow.
We defended our thesis, and it was something that we connected on right away and put it on the shelf for a few years. The jobs took us elsewhere for a little bit, and then dusted it off and had the opportunity to come back west to start Arabalus. But yeah, it was always on the horizon. It's just a matter of when.
And so what grape varieties are you working with your sparkling wines?
Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, a little bit of Meunier last year.
Mm.
We did Pinot Blanc last year as well. Cedric Bouchard, I'm coming after you.
Nice.
And we got some, again, Pinot Blanc again this year. No Pinot Meunier, but Pinot Blanc from Justice Vineyard. So when the Castiles call you up and say, do you want more fruit? I had to say yes before getting the approval from my CEO.
Dun, dun, dun. How'd that work out?
It was great. It was okay. Definitely a no-brainer. And we couldn't be more excited. The chemistry was perfect. So,
and are you making more than one label for the sparkling at the moment? Different styles, or are you focusing on one to start?
It'll always be under Arabilis, but there will be multiple. So the first wines that we're releasing next spring are two, and they're almost like mirror images of each other. So one is 67% Pinot, 33% Chard, all native, partial Malo, fermented and aged in barrel. Mm. And that's all from the Gorge. And then the other one is the complete opposite. So we inoculated, it's 67% Chardonnay, 33% Pinot, partial Malo, but it's kind of cool. And it's from the Coast Range. So it's a totally different wine. It's way more mineral driven, whereas the Pinot is a little bit more, you got the red fruit, the strawberry, a little bit, some opulence. But that's what we were going for, is like, we want to, there's a lot of ideas in this mad scientist brain, but 2021, we have three. Last year, we made five. This year, we made nine. So like, we're making more and more for different styles to go after.
That would be the thing that you talked about, the mad scientist brain, is I would have too many ideas and not enough. I mean, I haven't made any wine, so I would just mess it up right out the bat. How do you start on that first vintage, especially if a sparkling wine? Have you had experience with other traditional method winemakers that you've gotten a little bit of guidance from? Like, how do you approach that first vintage?
Lots of research. So I trained with Chateau Ste. Michel, and they're a big producer out here in the Northwest. And like, from a production size and like what they're doing, I mean, they're making clean, traditional method sparkling wines. My fascination was on the grower producers, because that's where we're headed, what we want to be. And so I just started reading Peter Liam's champagne books and
stuff,
messaging a bunch of people. Like, I would cold call everybody. And I mean, like Anselm Salos, I would write and we would be writing back. And I was just like, why is he communicating to some person in America that is just trying to learn? And it's all through observation for the most part. But trial small. So like, we made a lot of cider as grad students. We made some other wines back and then. And then when we were ready, it was like, okay, what fruit do we want to work with? What grapes have the right chemistry? You know, they're lower sugar than normal. What varieties and places can host those varietals really well? Going back to like the number of ideas, there are almost too many. And that's what's so cool about the opportunity with sparkling, is you're making a wine twice, maybe even three times when you factor the dosage in and impacting that final wine in the end. So it's almost maybe even just like chess, right? Like, you're thinking of the wine three steps away and influencing it that in that regard.
And then how are you choosing these different sites for different fruit? Like, why are certain sites more attractive to be made into sparkling wine as opposed to, say, just still?
So looking at weather patterns, trying to geek out on weather patterns and understand from the farmers, like, hey, what is, you know, peak heat in this area? When are you harvesting? What rootstock is this? And that's like getting into the nitty gritty. And some of your work colleagues probably know that pretty well. And like, but the interesting thing though is it's a very small range. And same with France and Tasmania, Spain, Italy. Yeah. Like, these areas are really small that can do it well or grow it well. And so for Oregon and California, most of these are very much influenced by the Pacific Ocean. And so like, where we are every night, 4:30, 5 o'clock, the Van Duzer corridor, and those winds start pulling in, because as the desert heat rises, it's sucking all that cold air in off the Pacific and it's cooling the grapes off, because we do get a pretty decent amount of heat here. But making sparkling wine just maybe 10 miles east of where we picked our gorge fruit, it's a desert. There are cactus growing near the Columbia River, and it's better suited for Syrah and Grenache and Cab Franc. Mm. Like, you wouldn't want to plant Pinot and Chardonnay, but where we were sourcing the fruit, it's literally right up against that rain shadow. And you would see the clouds coming in and like just mapping it. It's kind of cool.
It's very cool. Do you think, just on a little side note, because you mentioned this more arid desert area, which again, I don't think that a lot of people realize that about Oregon. They think, well, I'm a valley and, you know, the Pacific Northwest in general, just thinking of this almost kind of rainforest, kind of chillier, rainy, very green. But yeah, there is that other side to it. But given Allison's experience with Syrah, do you think you'd ever explore that as an option down the road?
Or it's on the table. No, it's on the table. A couple of our really good friends have some sites in on the Walla Walla side of Oregon. Okay. That if I made a couple calls, they'd probably trade some fruit with us.
It's good to know. But one thing at a time. See, I'm already sending you off to make more wine when you're dealing with all of your sparkling. So back to the sparkling. Another decision that you mentioned, using oak. So what's the decision there, oak versus stainless steel, for that finished wine?
More for texture than anything. And it's really just you're making a wine in a reductive environment during primary fermentation. And allowing it to age in oak just allows for a little bit of oxygenation to open up. Because when you are fermenting the wine again in the bottle, it's going back into a reductive environment. So no oxygen is being ingressed past that crown cap or cork. We'll probably get to that in a little bit. But for oak, it's really important for us that it definitely, and we have to be mindful, like whether it's new, however many years old that we're using. Most of the barrique that we're using, and some other champagne producers, I'll go on a quick side tangent, but when I was talking to Guillaume Doyard, his oak program is only,
I love Doyard.
Doyard is...
I forgot about Doyard. I can't believe it.
Yeah,
I used to sell so much of that because I just wanted to open it to taste it.
Stock up now because it's getting popular.
No, we didn't mention it. You didn't hear it.
Yes. He only uses oak that are 4 years old. So when he's trading out, it's in that realm because they're looking for just no oak, like that new oak impact. But still fresh enough that there's no kind of as the oak tannin kind of breaks down and over time, it's not impacting the overall wine. But if you look at Bollinger, like they're using oak cast from decades ago. So there's just very different styles that oak can impart, and then throw in stainless steel where it's just preserving freshness, purity in the wine in that regard. It's a lot of levers. There's a lot of levers that you can pull in just the vessel. Because when we were in Epernay and driving through the Cote de Blanc, like when you drive past Moët & Chandon's tank farm, the amount of wine that they're making in tank is insane.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But it's also like they need the back stock, back vintage. And so stainless is perfect for that. But you have Vilmar that's aging it in cask. So it's just just house style. What do you want? And I think that's what's kind of cool.
And then still, as far as texture goes, are you doing a lot of batonnage, a lot of stirring of those lees with these wines? Or are you kind of holding off on that?
We are holding off from our wines, only if it's getting sluggish in the primary to help kick up some nutrient into the wine and help it go dry. There are a couple of producers that do regular stirring. I know Aurelien Liert does some for Liert Frere. They do more regular batonnage stirring just for texture and that autolytic character. And maybe that wine goes into an early release. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. So batonnage is really useful if things are getting tough and tight, and especially if the books are getting tighter.
Sure. Yeah. You're mentioning all these producers though, and now I just want to drink sparkling. I want some champagne. So back to the cork thing you mentioned. Are you going to be doing traditional cork? Are you crown capping it? What's your approach with that? And what's the difference, you know, the pros and cons to both?
So tirage under crown cap versus cork. This is probably a really healthy debate, but we're doing both. And we're the first, from what I gathered from our cork supplier, and that we're the first in the U.S. to do it. So the hard part and why nobody is doing it is you have to disgorge by hand. So again, let's just make it more complex, Claire. Like, why not disgorge by hand? And risk losing all this wine. No, it's you have to freeze. You still have to freeze the plug in the neck freezer. So even if you're disgorging cork and crown cap, you have to freeze that. So the crown cap it's a steadfast solution. You know how much oxygen's coming into the wine. You can also age it pretty long. But there have been studies recently that Ruin Art released recently that cork is just as reductive as crown cap. Like they've done side-by-side comparisons, same wine, disgorged over time to see what that is. And so we did that in 2021. We bottled up 40 cases each, same wine, one under crown cap, one under cork. And we'll disgorge it every quarter just to see where things are. But if you think about the cork, it's a double disc. And so it's agglomerated on the top, and then you have these like thin cutouts of disc made of cork. There's no holes. So the glue that seals that, once it's squeezed into the neck, it pushes all the air out. So it eventually becomes reductive and doesn't allow any oxygen in.
So much work in making this kind of wine.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gives you an appreciation when you hear about all these different options and different, roads you can go down, and then the actual process of physically doing all that. It gives you such an appreciation for this style of wine, of this traditional method. Why did you ever consider maybe doing tank method, something a little more easy?
Nah, I mean, you're going to that much effort. Why cut one step shorter? I mean, there are some amazing tank method sparklings out there, like G.D. Vara's Moscato d'Asti, like pretty good.
Good call.
Like, and that, but that's like Frizzante, like really small level of carbonation. So, but no, it never was in our cards for us. But the Tanker Charmat, there are some producers up here that are doing that. Not in Oregon. I know of Washington that are doing some of that.
Well, and we've mentioned, so this style is most famous in Champagne. We've talked a lot about Champagne. You're using predominantly Champagne varietals. What makes Oregon and specifically the Willamette Valley different? What sets these two wines apart?
Oh, yeah. Somebody asked me this question recently too, and I think
it's a big one.
Yeah, totally. It is. I mean, soil is a big, big driver for what sets them apart. Climactically, we're pretty close. Champagne tends to track a little cooler on average, but Oregon's right there with them in terms of the temperature. You look at California, like they have some silica and chalky soils. Oregon has some marine sedimentary, it's not chalk, though I've seen some limestone deposits here and there that intrigue me for raising some Chardonnay on. But with Champagne, you dig anywhere from 6 inches to, I don't know, 6 feet, and you're hitting solid chalk. And I think that's what's so fascinating with how it's translating over into the final wine, that minerality. Here, I think we're getting some minerality and salty character from some of the soils. Like just over this hill is a vineyard that we source from that's all sand. It's just all this ancient marine sedimentary sand soil, and when you're walking and there's fossils of seashells and stuff. So it's here. Cool. It's just a matter of finding those sites that work. I think flavor profile-wise and sensorially, what Oregon has to offer, there are a lot of options in terms of ripeness, more acidic, kind of lemony, zingy. So I think we're figuring out like what would mark ourselves.
Do you think you have a little more freedom and room to play as well, as opposed to a place like Champagne where it's pretty set in stone what you can and cannot do?
100%. The rules and regulations with Champagne are really tight. So we bought a press before harvest started. Like actually the day harvest started this year, our press landed and I was wiring it up and everything. It was just a crazy day. And I remember because we were pressure testing some new programs from the CIVC over in Champaign, but you can't change it. You have to get a certain percentage of cuvée off 4,000 kg, weight of grapes. And then the second press is the tie, third press is the mark. You can't use the mark. It's sold off for distillation operations. Oregon just, they don't have that. There's so much freedom to say like, yeah, you can make a sparkling wine from Cabernet Franc. You can make a sparkling wine from Chenin Blanc. You know, we're not tied by the regionality and the laws around that for standardization. I do think, though, pros of that is it levels up the standards. You know, champagne standards are so really high. Yeah, and for good reason. It's a brand. You know what to expect when you're getting a champagne. And the quality is there, like even the farming. You can't grow the vines higher than 1.2 meters or something, or 1.5 meters. So it's down to that level and for reason. So I'm curious if it would ever come, if a band of us would get together and say like, yeah, you can't force carb a base wine and call it sparkling wine. Like it's going to be called carbonated wine. Like it's not on the same, it's not on the same playing field.
Do you find a lot of people are doing that? The forced carbonation?
There's a market. There is definitely a market. And I would say it got big in 2020 and it's only exacerbated since. And it doesn't have the same stability of the bubble as traditional. So
that's fair.
I'll leave it at that. It got my attention when somebody said, we are gonna show the traditional method producers that we can make just as good forced carbonated wine. I'm like, do it. Like most people, like that'll be its own, you know, segment in the marketplace. It's just not my style.
Speaking of the marketplace, how are you finding branding these sparkling wines? Is there a huge marketplace right now for sparkling wine coming out of Oregon? I think there should be, because it's delicious.
Yeah. And it's hot right now. Like people want the sparkling wine from Oregon, even California. Like you have Iron Horse, Racine's, Presqu'ile. Yep. Like there's some really good of that, but you know, Oregon is so hot. There's a reason why we're here and it's growing fast. Like there was a consortium that was put together. It's called Celebrate Sparkling. And there's a few of us that are coming together to push the envelope of what Oregon sparkling wine can be on the global stage. We're excited. And we're young and there's a lot more ahead of us.
That's so exciting. And I mean, not to, you know, plug any of your neighbors, but drinking the Lytle Barnett sparkling, the traditional sparklings on sparklers, those were hands down some of the favorites. And they absolutely, like, you know, Krug and Bruinart are obviously always going to be okay. But that was just so wonderfully, wonderful surprise. And we drank a lot of that for fun behind the scenes, probably a little too much of it, to be honest. So I'm always down to drink a traditional method from Oregon.
Yeah, jealous you got to. Andy makes some great wines. And Andrew, his winemaker, does a really great job. Andy Lytle's one. I don't know if you've heard of Corollary. Dan and Jean, they're another. Yeah. They just bought some vineyard acreage in Neola Amity. So they're starting. And that's solely focused for sparkling. There's a number of us here that are pushing that envelope.
And a lot of these are single vintage too. But I mean, I've seen a lot of blends, but I see a lot of, you know, single vintage really focusing on that one specific growing season, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah, no, there's definitely, so you have the vintage style wines, which is great because then you can see it, you definitely see it across the base. One producer that's done a great job in terms of non-vintage is Soder. Like Soder's Brut X. I don't know if you've had it.
I haven't had that yet.
It's a pretty wine.
I'm going to buy it now. Would you say, are you seeing more like blends or are you seeing a lot of people doing the single? Because you obviously in Champagne, you don't get that every year. Do you think that would ever be something in Oregon where like you only declare a vintage in the perfect years?
I think it depends on the model. For us, we're doing blends. We're doing non-vintage as well. We have vintage, single varietal.
Okay. So you're doing
single vineyard. I mean, I think it just depends in terms of what wines you like. A lot of people, like they just make one Blanc de Noir. Like Cho, their Blanc de Noir, Cho Wines, I don't know if that's another one. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's vintage and it's 5 years on lees. Like I think all theirs 5 years on lees is Blanc de Noir and it hits. And so like that's their house style. For us, we want to offer that variety. But that's where the options kind of provide you. Like if people aren't saving base wine, I think they should. You know, we have We're having climactic variations, vintage to vintage. Like, that's why champagne has non-vintage, because if there was a year that frosted out, burnt out the buds, or never got ripe, they have the backstock to tap into and still make their sparklers for that year.
And with variety too, I'm wondering, are you playing with residual sugar at all? I mean, the market's very much drawn towards the drier style, either the Brut Nature or Brut. I prefer, honestly, that extra Brut a lot of the time. I like that little bit of texture that just tiny extra little bump of sugar gives it. But are you playing with that at all, and any range?
Yeah, so when we do dosage trials, we're setting the guardrails wide, see like what's bringing this wine into balance, and then honing it from there. So we're disgorging a lot of wines at one time, three to five, and having different dosage levels. I agree. Like, extra Brut has a really nice place. Like, dosage, in my mind, and Solo said this, I don't want to take his words. It's salt. Like, if you think of a dish, it's like salt. You know, it's the final thing that just like enhances the flavor and makes things pop. And I totally agree with that. Like, unless you're hitting that pick perfectly, could you probably get away with Brut Nature? But then there's all those other factors like primary, secondary, no mallow, mallow, that you have to control to ensure that you aren't going to dose it 5 years or 24 months from now. But there is the marketplace is open to sweetness. I mean, look at La Marca Prosecco. Like, it's dosed higher than, say, Lytle Barnett. Like, Lytle Barnett is, I think, 1.5 grams dose in its final wine. It's still, I think he has the extra Brut in that. But that, it's just the expectation that customers have for that final wine or what they're buying off the shelf.
Do you think you'd ever go, like, make a special release that's, like, higher than a extra Brut? Getting into like dew or something like that?
I think it'd be awesome. Nobody has that like occasion or has experienced that. So to like surprise and delight a customer at the end of the night with a dessert sparkling, that dew or demi-sec, would be so badass.
It really is. And people like that. Like, when I would do pairings at a restaurant I worked at, you know, they're kind of these beautiful situations, because in a way you almost like force your guests, like, this is the journey you're on and you don't get to make any decisions to a certain point. But I found more often than not, the favorite pairing of the night was always the dessert with, you know, an off-dry sparkling.
Right on.
And they were just like, I usually don't like sweet. And I'm like, well, there's enough acidity, isn't there? It's pretty good with the... And it was hands down, like 90% of the time people wanted, they love that. And they're like, can I get a bottle of it? And I'm like, yes. Just drink more sweeter wines, because they're so good.
Yeah, totally.
And stuff.
Very much so. And I just think like that interaction with the carbonation and sweet acid, there's something refreshing about it.
It's not cloying. It's really, really lovely. And I think that'd be a cool, fun little experiment. So the sparkling wines are not released yet, as we mentioned. Where are they at in their process right now? How far out are we from getting them?
We are months. The goal is to launch in March of 2024. The reason why we're waiting until then is we have some equipment on the water. So it's being shipped from Champagne in Italy. And that's going to only enable us to ensure that I'm not disgorging by hand for our first go. We went to Champagne in January, and I was talking to like a bunch of our friends, so Flavian and Guillaume, like they've become really close friends of ours, and just trying to understand what level that they're able to control and what level that they aren't able to control. We never want to get big enough where we aren't able to control the process. And so for us, it's the equipment is very important to control that quality from end to end.
That's
fair. So you've gotten that far, and to disgorge a bottle and watch 50% of it blow out.
Oh my God.
Don't want to do that.
That would be foolish. We can wait. We can wait until March, I suppose.
Yeah.
Where can we find Arabalus wines, whether it be in stores around Oregon or online, social media? Follow you guys?
Follow us at Arabalus Wines on Instagram and Facebook, arabaluswines.com. You can buy direct. We are locally distributed in Oregon, but we do partner nationally to ship it everywhere. So we want to get Arabalus on everybody's tables and share those moments and memories as much as we can.
And you have a mailing list on your website. If I sign up for that, will I get an alert when those sparklers are ready to go?
You will, okay. And there will be more information to follow that process and journey along the way.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to go do that. I recommend that all of you go do that as well. Go follow Arabalus Wine on social media, check out their website, order some of their lovely still wines, the Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs that are available right now. They also, if you are fortunate enough to live in that beautiful area behind Kenny there, you can go and book a private tasting with them too. So absolutely go check out Arabalus Wines. Thank you so much, Kenny, for your time and for geeking out on sparkling wine with me.
Anytime, Clara. This was wonderful. We'll see you soon.
Cheers.
I want to thank everybody for listening to today's podcast. I want to thank Claire Copey for hosting and John Adams for producing. Do not forget to subscribe to SomTV. You can watch this episode that you just listened to right now on SomTV.com. I want to remind you again that Cup of Salvation is opening in New York City on the 7th of December and tickets are available right now. Go to SomFilms.com to get those tickets before they sell out. Everybody be safe and drink something nice.